I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guests are indie filmmakers and brothers Mark Duplass and Jay Duplass. They're joined in conversation by Rachel Rosen, Director of Programming for the San Francisco International Film Festival. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Mark Duplass, Jay Duplass, and Rachel Rosen.
Filmmaker siblings Mark and Jay Duplass grew up making movies using their father's VHS camera, but it wasn't until they were in their mid to late 20s that their artistic vision really fell into place with This Is John, a 7-minute film made on a $3 budget, and yes, that's right, a $3 budget, that went on to play at the 2003 Sundance Film Festival. The brothers went on to make additional films, including The Puffy Chair, Cyrus, and Jeff, Who Lives at Home. They also created, wrote, and directed the HBO series Togetherness, which Mark co-starred in. Jay currently co-stars in Transparent, and who could forget their turn as the world's dreamiest midwives on The Mindy Project? Their new memoir, Like Brothers, is about the rewards and traps of their close relationship as brothers and artistic collaborators. Tonight, Mark and Jay are joined in conversation by SF Films Director of Programming, Rachel Rosen. So please join me to welcome Mark Duplass, Jay Duplass, and Rachel Rosen to the stage.
It's exciting.
So I'm just going to start off with the most basic question, which is, you guys are very busy and you're very prolific in the film and TV world. So it wasn't like you were sitting around with a lot of spare time thinking how to fill it. Why did you want to write this book?
I mean, I think the first thing that occurred to us is, you know, making films and television has been pretty good to us financially, but we really wanted to make a big score in the book world, because that's where the cash comes flowing in.
It's really the future, guys.
It is.
Is cutting down trees and writing words on it.
We are cutting edge in this regard.
Right? I mean, totally obvious.
The not so interesting answer is that we were actually approached by this lovely woman, Pamela Cannon, who was our editor, and she said, "I think you guys are ready to write a book." And we said, "We don't think we are. We don't know what we're doing, and we're in our sort of mid 40s, and there's a lot of life left." And she said, look, I think that, you have some things to say, so think about it. And Jay and I had our little internal conversation. You're going to learn a lot about these when you read the book, where we asked ourselves that seminal question we ask before we make anything, which is like, okay, all of you have, 500 movies and TV shows on your Netflix queue and another 50 to 100 books you want to read. If we're going to make something, it should at least offer something, so it's just not another thing that you feel guilty about not getting to. And then when we started talking about that, we kind of both started talking about how, for better or for worse, Jay and I, we get hit up a lot by up-and-coming artists of all disciplines who say, like, could I take you to coffee and just, like, pick your brain, which is their nice way of saying, like, you're a genetic B minus and you made it. If you can do it, I sure as hell can figure this out. And
it's a nice compliment.
It is. It feels good. It feels good. And the truth is they're right. We agree. But as you said, we're kind of workaholics and we're husbands and dads. And so we don't have a lot of time for that. And so we thought this would be a good place to kind of step that out. And then I think the second thing, which was more of a discovery of the book, was like, a study on our collaborative process and the feeling of like how close we got growing up in the middle of nowhere with no connections to the industry and kind of linking arms and saying, oh, if we're going to do this, we should like basically link everything, arms, soul, spirits, the whole thing. And we didn't think that was weird until people started perceiving our energy in the industry, and they were always saying things just like, like, North American dudes don't speak to each other the way that you guys talk to each other. There's, like, so much validation and so much hugging and so many tears. and so we thought, okay, well, that maybe is something, too.
So is that second part something you knew would be a part of the book, or was it something you wanted to work through while you were writing the book?
It was something that I don't think we thought it would be a big part of the book. I thought we just thought it would be baked in the way that it normally is, because we would make movies and TV shows and people would be like, wow, the male relationship was very unusual. A lot of I love yous and stuff. And we were just like, yeah, like just male friendship, right? And they were like, no, there's way more punching involved normally.
People started to use the words like, we found it very odd. And then we realized we're like, oh yes, male intimacy often as presented in somewhat mainstream art, it takes the form of things like I Love You, Man, where it's like either a farce or like the inherent comedic device is like slight homophobia, basically, you know? So yeah, that kind of occurred to us. It was like, as we started digging in, that it grew, and then I think in particular for us, you know, something kind of pivotal happened when we were making Togetherness, and it was sort of the height of our like working together, writing, directing, producing every single episode together on set 14 hours a day, and when Togetherness got canceled, that opened up a little bit of space in our relationship. And that was while we were writing the book. And that was, I guess, part of the surprise of this book was us. I think we thought initially this was going to be more of a treatise or a manifesto on the greatness of what our bond was and our union was. And it was. I mean, it was. I have no qualms in saying, like probably the greatest years of my life were us in our creative discovery mode in our teens and our 20s. But it then turned into kind of an examination of some of the downsides of that and how that kind of swallowed us up. And we had a distinct lack of being able to individuate in that partnership.
The book's also, I won't say unusual, but it's construction.
Odd. No, it's kind of odd.
It's odd.
Kind of weird. Kind of it's just different. You know.
Well, you'll see when you read it. Because it has a lot of different things and themes that run through it. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about just sort of how you worked out what the book was going to be constructed of.
Yeah, I mean, I think the process was a lot like how we came up making movies, how we continue to do stuff, which is very like cavemanish and insular and just grunting and trying things and failing and pushing each other off of cliffs and being like, you okay? All right, come back up. You know, just
that scene in Zoolander when they're trying to get the files out of the computer. Remember that?
That's basically how we work. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of unusual things about the book. There's like the voicing in the book, we use the royal we a lot, which was also like one of our title ideas for the book. It was way too regal for us because we're just basically puttering around in our underwear most of the time, but the royal we didn't seem to fit. But, you know, but we also write chapters individually, and, you know, it's partially a memoir, partially just like a how-to in terms of how we came up in the business. And then, like we were saying before, I think the biggest surprise was this sort of like avalanche of discovery on our part because, you know, like, because we are so insular and because we have locked arms and because we've made movies in this very immigrant style, sort of just like put your head down and just keep making stuff and divulge yourself, we didn't have, you know, in interviews we would learn how to articulate how we came up and what our process was, but we had never done that in regards to our relationship and what we had been through. And I think this book was that was brand new for us in terms of like, wow, what did we do? That was unusual. And when there's two of you, it weirdly allows you to go through more stuff because you're there to support
tougher.
Each other, but you kind of look at the other one and you're like, he's not having a panic attack and diarrhea. He was secretly, but like, I didn't know. You know, and you just kind of like push through and, you know, we were able to kind of like understand, because, you know, like Mark said, with Togetherness, we really reached a point where I would say like 99% of our brotherhood was being put into making that show, Togetherness. It required all of it. And at the end of the day, of a 14-hour day, you don't want to hang out and go get a beer with your brother. You speed home so that you can be a decent dad and a decent husband for that moment. It was a big uncovering of like what we have been through, and also like realizing that we don't have to do that anymore. We don't have to put our heads down and ram it into a wall until it opens up and then we're like, okay, what's next? You know, I think that's been a big part of our journey, and this book being a sidestep in a way too is like when you do link arms and you approach things, you know, the way that like our grandfather and his brothers and their sons made a dry cleaning business in the late 30s, and you're just surviving, like it's hard to turn that off, that compulsion to make stuff, the compulsion to just like beat each other up and beat a project up within each other. So that's kind of where we are right now, and it's brand new.
That's exciting. And scary, I'm sure,
yeah,
too.
Yes. Yeah.
So you talk in the book about how your filmmaking was informed by films that you had watched and like movies you watched on TV. I'm wondering, when you were like, okay, now we're going to write a book, did you read a lot of other sort of books by filmmakers or like artist memoirs?
No, we made that mistake in our early days as filmmakers of like essentially being derivative and trying to find influences to help us make our stuff. And you know, we came from the suburbs of New Orleans, and there were no links to the film industry whatsoever, right? And so when we were coming up, this idea that we might go make movies, it seemed so far away that I think that's part of why we kind of linked up the way that we did. But then what happened is we started thinking, well, if we're going to make a movie, we should make the movie like the one that we really like, you know? And I think that's a common mistake that a lot of young artists make, is you make the things that you are a fan of, but you don't actually make the things that you are uniquely qualified to make. And it took us a little longer than the average person, about 12 years of failing, before we realized what we were even close to good at. So when it came time for writing the book, I mean, that's one thing good, is that we had a massive learning curve and that we didn't know how to write a book. But as artists, we were a little bit ahead of the curve, and knowing that the more we try to think about things and wrap our heads around it and say, should this be in first person singular? Should it be? And when we put that stuff aside and we just go right into our stomach and just start grunting around and putting things on the page, that is how we personally excel as artists, you know? And we very much realize that, like, there are people out there like the Coen brothers who can use their magical A-plus brains and see a whole movie and go ahead and execute that thing. But when we tried to do that, which was really ages, you know, 18 up until we were in our late 20s, we really failed miserably as artists. And it was tough.
So, as you mentioned, the book uses we. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's clear which one of you is writing.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not. Were there things that you were actually writing at together at the same time, and how did that mm-hmm. work? Or did you always just break out and then...
We haven't written in the same room on anything that's ever been successful.
Yeah.
Ever.
It doesn't really work. We orally tell each other stories a lot, and mm-hmm. We learned a lot in the development process of, like, you know, when a story is coming together, you like try it out on people, and then when you watch their eyes start to droop, you're like, oh, that's not working too well, or you start to feel yourself talking really fast because you don't know what happens next, and you're getting nervous, and you start fumbling, and that tells you a lot. So we do a lot of that together, but the writing in this book was very separate in a good way. You know, mm-hmm. we would just say, hey, let's try this chapter out, and we rewrote each other's stuff a lot. And I remember at some point, like, Jay telling me after I had done a rewrite on one of his chapters, he was like, "You like voice that in my voice better than I voice that in my own voice." And that's part of the benefit of having spent 40 years in lockstep with each other, is we're able to do things like that for each other.
Oh, cool. So we shouldn't always assume we know who's writing.
You can assume, but you know what that does? That makes an ass out of you and me, man.
I mean, it's
my daughters love that one, by the way. You break that down for like a 10-year-old, oh, dude.
The process you're describing of writing the book sounds similar to the process that you describe when you're working on writing together film and TV. Were there any major differences, or was it basically the same process that you use?
It's very much the same process. I mean, I think, and this is something that we are discovering more and more about ourselves and our owning and being able to articulate more, but, you know, I think part of being brothers, being kind of like soulmates, joined together making art, is we came up in a very different way from how Hollywood works or traditional storytelling works in general. You know, in Hollywood, there's this idea that the director is a dictator and he's an auteur, and they have to see and know everything. And
they usually have baseball caps and are chewing gum.
Smack gum loudly. A vest would also help. But, you know, Mark and I work in this different way where our egos, because you are joined, your egos have to go. Like, egos are the first thing that gets in the way of, like, making something when you're a partner with
None left. They were beaten out of us for 12 years.
Like, I mean,
it's true.
They got beaten out of us.
It's one of the best things that happened to us as artists, I think.
Like, failing very consistently for 10 years.
When Jay and I come together with an exciting idea, the energy is so different. And I think people remark on it, too, because it's very specifically not, "I got it, let's do it, I know what to do, give me my space." It's usually like, "This feels like a good idea, parenthetical, but I've been wrong 1,000 times, so I have no idea if I'm right. Will you help me raise my C-minus idea into something that will be communicable to an audience?" And our whole, I mean, collaborating with each other has been that way for a long time. And I think what, you know, we're talking about now is like, as togetherness opened up for us and gave us some space, we started to realize, like, okay, we're soulmates, this is wonderful, we climbed a mountain together, but we have our own wives and our own children, and like Jay being on Transparent was a very big thing for us, because like I always used to go out and act on movies, and it was, I used to say it was like really fun because I could have an affair on our creative partnership and our marriage, and it felt really, really good, and Jay never got to do that, and then...
Goddamn cuckold.
Yeah, exactly right. And he went away to do Transparent, and I was like, he was like, "I don't know if I should do this. I'm so busy. I don't know if I'm an actor?" And I was like, "You should absolutely do this. It's so great. Have a great time." And I watched him go.
And plus, it was like not a big deal. I was going to do a web series, right, on like Amazon.com, the place you buy your toilet paper.
Yeah,
it's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah, it'll be one season and it'll be done. There won't be any Golden Globes. There won't be. And then when I watched him, like, take off as an artist singularly and then make all these creative connections outside of me, it was so deeply threatening in a way that, like, knocked me on the floor. Like, all day long, I could sit here and just be like, "I love my brother. I want him to sail and have everything. No, don't go too far." And so... The last 3 years of our partnership have been really interesting for us because we are trying to figure out how to be soulmates with space. We are kind of consciously uncoupling, if you will. Like Gwyneth Paltrow and that lovely man from Coldplay. And
we had to break up to find the love again.
That's right. And it's been, on Monday, we're like, "This is so great, it's so wonderful." And then Tuesday, we get all nostalgic and we miss when it was just the two of us against the world and we were each other's everything, and then on Wednesday it flips back again, and it's really, it's very emotional, you guys.
You're listening to indie filmmakers and brothers Mark and Jay Duplass, whose new book is Like Brothers. They're joined in conversation by Rachel Rosen on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, the book is, I mean, it's kind of a breakup book.
It is.
I didn't want to say it until you guys did, because it's a little bit of a spoiler, because you go through that evolution in the
book.
Yeah,
and I mean, I would say to say breakup maybe is like a little too far, but it's definitely like cracking open and trying to figure out where the space is. And the good news is, for us at least, is like this has allowed not only good things for us personally, but professionally. We can now, we've like widened our circle of collaboration to our groups of friends and types of filmmakers who know how to make things that we don't know how to make. So now our company can produce movies like Tangerine and movies. Yeah, I'm gonna start naming movies, and you guys just start clapping every time. If anybody has IMDb, just pull it up. We'll go through 41 of them, and then we'd all get out of here. It'll be great. But like Wild Wild Country was a great example of that, where like we love documentaries and we've always wanted to be a part of them, but most documentarians are broke and sad, and we're kind of not willing to like do that full time.
We don't want to ruin our lives, but if you want to,
yes, we'll produce you.
We'll give you an office, yeah, and you can ruin your life in that office.
And that's been so great for us to be able to have enough space to kind of do those things. So it's definitely been bittersweet the whole time, but yeah, it's new.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of a breakup is like, it's interesting because it's like, very specifically, I think what we are breaking up is this idea that we need to be lockstep in partnership and doing everything together.
And by the way, no one told us that we did that to ourselves.
We did that. Yeah. We both subconsciously for the first 10 years of like being successful, we thought we were going to be the Coen brothers. But that's what we always wanted to be. We wanted to be, and then we realized we are the opposite of them, basically, as filmmakers. But we still wanted to be those two brothers who wrote and directed things in perpetuity, you know? And as we've come through, it's like, I got on Transparent, and I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe it, but I not only love this, but I love acting, and I want to do this for real, despite the fact that I hated all theater people in high school. But Mark, you know, and Mark has emerged as this brilliant producer who can, I mean, the way that he can model projects and the way that he can, like, build a script and write the first draft of a script in no time flat. So we've both been kind of surprised at how we've differentiated from, and that writing-directing thing was primarily directing. I mean, the reason we started writing is so we have cool material to direct. The reason why we produced was so that we could show up on set and have it be built the way that we wanted to build it. And we've been surprised by how we've differentiated in our own interests and also in what we think we're particularly good at.
Yeah.
And that's been surprising. So it's less of it's the breakup of that Coen Brothers-y idea of what we thought we were going to be, but now we still have a company, and it's like the idea is like, how can we support each other in doing what we want to do most? And hey, I have this, and I could really use your help in this area if you want to.
And not limit each other in any way, because, you know, that lockstep thing that Jay is talking about, it was so critical to come from the suburbs of New Orleans, not knowing anything about how to be an artist, for us to have each other, and as Jay describes, and it's almost like that immigrant mentality. We were immigrants coming into Hollywood, and like, stick with your family, stick close, subordinate any grievances or any differences, because you don't belong here, and you got to lockstep together. And that was so great as we were building things, but we realized over the course of time that, like, the way that we operate, this is kind of specific, but something we get into the book, and I think it's important for those of you who are, like, collaborating. It took us a long time to figure this out, is that our taste levels have remained actually quite similar, but as we've differentiated as people, we've discovered not only different skill sets, but the way we operate. For instance, my brain is, like, kind of spastic and fireworksy, and it comes up with lots of different ideas. And this is all false you know, humility aside. Like, most of which are not good. A couple of them are really interesting. But it comes really fast. And then Jay's brain a lot of times works in this way where, like, if you give him space and time to do a deep dive into something, like, he will find something unique that you can't find. But he can't often find that while my brain is just burning his face while he's deep diving. And likewise, like, when Jay's deep diving, he's, like, putting out my fires, and it's, like, cramping my style. And we had to, like, be honest with each other about that and be like, that combination was great for a long time, but also not also great for our happiness at times. And so we've had to learn how to, like, you know, I have to stay away from Jay when he's, like, birthing something, so I don't, like, light him on fire. And he has to kind of stay away from me a little bit, so he's, like, not, like, cramping my style while I'm burning up. And, you know, like, it's just, I mean, it sounds like one never-ending therapy session, and the only reason it sounds like that is because it absolutely is, basically.
It's goddamn exhausting.
Yeah.
I want to switch it up and talk to you a little bit just about improvisation and how important that is for your work.
Yeah.
And you can respond to that in any way. I was thinking about it when you were describing how you're different from the typical Hollywood person, and that must be different for the people that you work with if you're showing up and they're
right.
expecting to be sort of put on a mark and told what to do, and you're
the core of it is that, for me at least, ours is a process of discovery as opposed to a process of exacting a preconceived vision. And we were a little naive when we went into Hollywood, because everybody loved our movies out of Sundance, and they said, well, we'll pay for your movies. And when we signed up to do Cyrus, which was like a $7 million studio movie, I think that we were naive, thinking like, well, we'll just tell them, here's the script, but we'll improvise it and we'll discover it on set. We'll see you later. You know, and that kind of wasn't fair to them, I think. But at the same time, they had a hard time trusting us because we were first-time studio filmmakers. And I think that they had a hard time believing that because we were willing to discover things, because we were willing to listen and be open and validate like we do with each other, they unfortunately interpreted that as either we were weak and could be steamrolled, or we didn't have vision. And that was kind of a bummer that we discovered then, that we didn't really fit that well in that system. And like the one night that they really pushed us hard, like I actually started yelling. And that was when they unfortunately were like, oh, these guys have vision. Oh.
Oh, they know what they're doing.
They
okay,
they're
never
doing.
Mind. They're yelling.
And
we're good.
That,
we're good.
And the fact that that worked almost killed us.
Yeah.
And so immediately at that point, we realized that playing with other people's money was like almost not fair to them, because we want to be able to discover, and definitely not fair to us, because they were going to have to like have all the answers when we wouldn't get them until we got to set. And improvisation is a big, big part of that. And it really informed the business model we have today, which is we rode the hill up to Sundance, and then we said, oh, we made a movie that sold at Sundance. Now we go into the studio system. We made two in there, and then we're like, we're not going to last here. We're gonna have heart attacks, or we're going to burn out. So we turned right back around, went right back down into the independent sphere, and discovered a really new way of making movies for us, which was like, if we just make these cheaply and use some of the money that we've made either on writing gigs, or I was on that show The League for a while, which like really helped like pay for a lot of our projects. Thank you. I'm going to keep saying project names. I got to do that. And then we started realizing like, oh, let's not make it for $7 million at Fox Searchlight. Let's make it for $100,000 on our own. And then everybody works for like a pretty good day rate, and then they share massive profits in the movie, and then we'll go to Sundance and sell it for like a big amount, and then everybody shares in the profits. And that system came out of us essentially kind of failing in the studio system.
But I would say that the improv is part of a bigger system, which is just like kind of making things up as we go. You know, we failed for so long. We're partners. When we're on set, we're not looking to exact words that were written a year ago in
or
some,
3 years ago
in some yeah. fugue state. We are trying to like make an environment where lightning and strike and can strike, and we can like achieve some level of reality. So that's on the acting side. So I mean, if anything, the improvisation is its goal based improvisation, where actors are we're just trying to achieve something that's real in the moment, and we feel like that is probably the thing that we do uniquely have to offer as filmmakers, is a scene where you see it and you're like, that was real. Because it was, and the actors
to a certain degree
know exactly what was going to happen. But the system of also like being vulnerable on set as a director and saying like, you know what, I don't know. You know what, I think this part of the scene is broken, and I think
I don't know how to fix it.
I don't know how to fix it.
We're going to go walk around the block.
We're going to go.
Studios love that one.
They love it.
That's their favorite when you tell them.
And actors have a hard time too. I mean, I think what Mark and I have learned how to do is live in chaos on set.
And
you know?
Work with what's working, too, is a big part of
yes,
it, too.
Yes, go with what's working. But everyone on set wants you to move on. Your best friends on set, every single person that is on a film set comes up to you and like, are we good? Did we get it?
Did
we
get
move
it?
On?
That's the question.
And these are all people that we love and they love us, but like all the pressure in the world is to move on. And people are like, well, when did you sell it? It's like, you can sell out at every second.
That's how bad movies are made, is caving to the pressure of, did we get it? And somewhere in your brain, you're like, maybe we didn't get it, but 100 people will love me if I say, yes, we got it, and we can end on budget and on schedule. And you do that, and then you make a turd. That's what happens.
Yeah.
We've made so many. We know
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, from the book, I know that the process of discovering that that's what you were looking for came relatively early in your career.
It felt really late at the time.
I know, you keep saying years and years, but...
29. I was 29.
Jay was 29.
And we had been making movies consistently and editing movies, and we had made a few shorts and a couple of digital features.
Yep.
And then it wasn't, you know, basically what happened
those are premiering in our mom's basement. If
yeah. tickets are $1 million.
Yep.
Basically, what happened was, I was at the end of my rope. Mark was approaching it. You know, I was about to turn 30, and I was just kind of done. You know, I was like, I've dragged myself through this enough. I've dragged Mark and my parents through it enough. Like, it's embarrassing. You know, like, all my friends are getting married and having kids and buying houses and thriving, and I'm living off of $15,000 a year in peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, you know. And it was that day that Mark, who has always been, you know, he's always the gas in our relationship, and he was like, we're going to make a movie today. And I was like, this was early 2000s when digital wasn't out yet, and, you know, I was like, we don't have a 16-millimeter camera, we don't have lights, we don't have people. You needed to have people to do it. And Mark's idea was like, well, we have mom and dad's home video camera. I'm going to go to 7-Eleven, and I'm going to buy a tape, and you're going to come up with an idea by the time I come back.
And I ran out very quickly, and I left him holding the bag, which is something I'm very good at.
So this is like, you know, we're at the end of our rope here, and I was at the end of my wits, and I didn't have the luxury of intellectualizing an idea, approximating the Coen brothers. I didn't have any of that. I had an apartment and a video camera and Mark. And so the thing that came to me was something that had happened to me 2 weeks prior, which is that I tried to perfect the personal... I tried to record my outgoing answering message, which on an actual answering machine, this is how old this was. And I failed to do so. It took me many attempts, and I had a nervous breakdown in the middle of it. And Mark came back, and I told him about the idea, and he said, okay, I'm going to go get dressed. When I come in the door, roll camera.
It was not the the best-looking movie to play at the Sundance Film Festival that year. But that was, you know, that was kind of crazy for us because obviously that was the cost of the tape, and we submitted it to Sundance on a lark, and we got in that year, and then we felt like, we don't belong here, this must be a mistake, and then, like, we won the Short Film Award that year, and we have stayed very close to this process as much as we could through our careers, because first of all, we just were scared if we strayed from it, we'd fail again. And we sort of incrementally built everything from here. Our next short the next year was, there were two actors in that one, which was crazy.
It was still in a kitchen.
Still shot in a kitchen. And then we did our feature, The Puffy Chair, which kind of followed the same ethic, really cheaply made. And we just kind of tried to take things like very slowly and incrementally, but always, for us, what was the priority is we realized all those movies we were trying to make before, we tried to make a movie about a runner from South Texas, and we weren't authorities on those subjects, but this is like what we uniquely had to offer. This is basically the tragic comedy of our lives and persecuting ourselves on film tended to work, you know? And I think that, like, you know, a lot of people are always asking us, like, you know, how did you find your stuff? What is the thing? You know, and we're always feel like somewhere around like 2 o'clock in the morning when you're having that conversation with someone you're very, very close with, when they're admitting to you, oh my God, I had a nervous breakdown when I was trying to perfect the personal greeting in my answer machine, and you giggle about it, and somebody cries a little bit. That stuff that feels like so personal to you that you couldn't possibly even communicate it to people, that's probably where you should start.
Yeah, I mean, this was like shown at Sundance at a time. I mean, like, the stuff at Sundance is still pretty heavy-hitting, but back in the day, like, it was mostly hardcore dramas.
Yeah.
You know, this was playing like the Christmas Eve screening of Dumb and Dumber at Sundance. It was like people, but it was a weird screening because you guys know it ended well because we're here and stuff, but we were having the audience, like half the audience thought he was going to kill himself.
Yep.
So that people were like cringing and then laughing and then say, don't laugh, don't laugh. This is going to end bad. It was like this wild, crazy moment. And it was uniquely what we had to offer is just thrown up there.
And like, I guess we talked about this a little bit, but probably not enough is like, I think part of the reason we got to that place is that we just, like, we never left the bus stop for years and years and years.
We ran out of bad ideas, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
And then got stuck with this, like, good one, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, you described how you sort of passed through the studio system, mm-hmm. going back to doing in more independent work so you could work like this. I have to admit I was honestly surprised that you can still manage to keep this level of openness in your work, you know, that's just by its nature, because it does cost more than $3, yeah. a little more circumscribed. I had a conversation with an actress who was in an episode of Room 104, mm-hmm. and she was like, well, yeah, they sent me the script, and I took it because I really loved the script, and then I got to the set, and Mark was like, "Yeah, we're not gonna use that script. We're just gonna improvise."
We used to get in trouble with that on Togetherness, like Amanda Peet all the time. We'd be like, "Dude, why aren't we doing the script? It's so good." We're like, "Cause you practice it in the mirror, and now we have to change it so it looks totally fresh. And you'll do it so much better than our words because it will be new. But you'll have ingested what our intention was. So it's not like she's like improvising about like." You know, chocolate-covered toasters for comedy. She's improvising the dramatic core of the scene, but every time she's doing it, she's fumbling over her words, and it just, I don't know. We just love documentaries, so we're always trying to have our narratives approximate that feeling of freshness that documentaries have for us.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features indie filmmakers and brothers Mark and Jay Duplass, whose new book is Like Brothers. They're joined in conversation by Rachel Rosen. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, let's talk about your love of documentaries and some of your mentoring work. That's what I mean, that's the way it seems to me. So you can correct me if I'm wrong. But at this point in your careers, you're doing a lot of executive producing. Yeah. You're helping other filmmakers get their work done. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how you started doing that, why you like doing that, yeah, how you choose what films you're going to help?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely similar to everything else we do where we accidentally stumbled upon it, like we accidentally stumbled upon this thing, you know? The first thing that we produced was a film for Brian Poyser, who was in film school with us in UT Austin. And we happened to be getting paid to write Cyrus at the time. And he called us and he said, "Hey, guys, I'm making an $18,000 movie. $5,000 of funding just dropped out. We shoot tomorrow. And if I don't get $5,000, the movie dies." And so for Mark and me, at that point, it was literally just money. It was just like, oh, we can both afford $2,500. And so we gave him the money. And then we did what we always do, is we, you know, consulted on edits. We weren't on set at all, but, you know, he's a good filmmaker, and we believe in him and wanted to see the movie get made. And then his movie actually got into competition at Sundance, and they were called us executive producers. And we were like, oh, yeah, yeah, we're producers.
We bought Blazers.
So, yeah. You know?
It's important.
Jay still got his. Got my producer blazer on. Yep. It was, that was the start of it, honestly. It was just like sort of accidental. We were the first people in our peer group to make money. And, you know, we also were the first people to like get grinded through the industry. We were the first people to like sell movies at Sundance. So it was just like, we just started answering questions and helping people and honestly having survivor's guilt and trying to help them avoid all the potholes that we stepped in and along the way.
That was a big part of it. And then there's this other more selfish part of it now for us, which is like working with, you know, younger or less experienced or hungrier filmmakers, whatever age they might be, kind of juices us up a little bit too, because they bring something new to the equation that we don't quite understand yet or that we've lost, you know? And so some forms of the collaborations are like, I make these little movies called Creep with my friend Patrick Bryce, who was just out of film school. He didn't know anything, but he was brilliant, really nice, and so there was a lot of mentoring and like teaching him how to make those movies, and then now he's just like flown the coop and he's solid and can do whatever he wants. But again, there are other things we do similar to what Brian Poyser did, or like when we were mentioning Tangerine and Wild Wild Country, where fully formed great filmmakers are coming to us. I mean, the boys who made Wild Wild Country, we call them the boys because they're like 10 years younger than us. they took it all over town.
They're bald with gray hair.
Yeah, exactly. No one wanted to buy Wild Wild Country. They took it all over, and everybody passed on it. And so, like, we had one very clear job to do. I would love to take all the creative credit for that show, but we can't. Like, we gave them cash. We gave them full creative control and protection, set them up at Netflix, who's comfortable to give us Final Cut, which we're like, great, okay, boys, take the Final Cut, go ahead. And, you know, they moved into our office spaces on the east side of LA, and that's where we're editing, like, Room 104, and so they're meeting other filmmakers and testing their episodes on them and involved in a community, and that's really all we had to do to kind of give them that little leg up they needed. And so that's something we're really excited to be able to do now, because frankly it doesn't require like a huge amount of time for us when you're really like giving it to people who are so hungry and willing to go for it. And then as to shows like Room 104, that's been really great for us because it's a way for us to still feel really creative. Like, you know, we're still writing a ton of those scripts, but we don't really direct a lot of those episodes, and we hand them off to, like, we're trying to, that's one where we can very easily support like women filmmakers and persons of color, give them their first directing job in the industry. And our feeling is like, we're very experienced directors and we're good at it, but like the 27-year-old Sundance short filmmaker who gets their first chance at this, the way that they prepare, the enthusiasm they bring to it, there's just as good of a chance that they're going to do it as good, if not better than us, because of like how excited they are for it. And so we've kind of realized like delegation through the years has been like a really fun part of the producing process where, you know, I think, again, we've said this a lot, but in the early part of our career, we felt like we got to write and direct everything and do it so it's going to be good. And now we're kind of like, there's a lot of really talented people out there. We just need to embolden them and give them the step.
I mean, there's a small irony, having read the book, where, you know, one of your messages to filmmakers is, like, don't wait for the cavalry to come. Like, just go out, do your thing, don't wait for the cavalry.
Yeah.
But it's kind of interesting because for some people now you are the cavalry.
We are.
Yeah.
But we still don't think they should wait for us.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't wait for us. I mean, there are so many people who put all their hopes and dreams into, like, one movie, for instance. There was a very common model when we were coming up where this is back in the early 2000s, and you will know this model so well, where people spend 6 to 7 years preparing and raising money to make a $500,000 Super 16 millimeter movie. This is happening in various other formations, but back in the early 2000s, this was the thing that would destroy filmmaker after filmmaker. You just watch them topple. And what would happen is they would spend 6 or 7 years raising money, and they're no longer a filmmaker. They are not practicing what they have come to do. They're good at fundraising now. And so two things happen is they show up on set and they're not really a practiced filmmaker anymore. And number two, they're sick of their script they wrote 6 years ago, and the movie would be mediocre and they'd never ever make another movie again because you can't recover from $500,000 loss, you know? So like in the advent of like, you know, digital filmmaking, it doesn't have to cost $500,000, but people do that. And the one thing that Mark and I always try to say is, you know, make stuff cheaply so that you can fail and pick yourself back up and do it again. And that's probably the only thing that is the reason why we're here today.
We had a couple of expensive ones in there. Those hurt pretty
bad. I mean,
bad.
Yeah, we had a $70,000 movie in there. That was by far the most expensive. All of other failures.
All of them were cheap. Yeah,
were very, very cheap.
Yeah.
And that was because we had made this. We made $70,000 and we just threw it into a movie. But yeah, I think allowing yourself to fail. Because, I mean, there's this myth that you're going to wake up one morning and you're going to take a crap and a good movie's going to come out or a bad movie's going to come out, and that's going to determine whether you're a good filmmaker or not. But that's crazy. This is the most complex art form that I can imagine, the amount of talents that you have to synthesize in order to make a movie. Like, no one expects a painter to, like, make one painting. But I think it's because of the culture that we live in. We've all seen so many movies and we relate to them in this really intimate way. So we just think that we can create them. But the truth is that there's so much craft in it. And it
takes time.
It takes time and it takes failure. And it takes a continuing communication with your audience. I mean, look, the filmmakers that are coming through Room 104, they haven't had one short film at Sundance or one feature at Sundance. They've had many, many, many films. And it surprises us, actually. I think that's probably the most unique thing about us is that when we were coming up, we expected to fail. Yeah. And when we made a movie, we were aware that it was a movie. You know, even when we shot this, we weren't like, oh, this is great. We did it. When we shot this, we were like, wow, that was different.
That was interesting.
And it was that feeling, and I will say personally behind the camera, it was the first time ever behind the camera that I laughed and cried during a take, and that, you know, Mark could feel that, and we were whispering and communicating, you know, just, we knew that something big had happened on camera and that it came to fruition. There was a beginning and a middle and an end, but we didn't really know what it meant, you know, but it was because we showed it to our friends, and David Zellner, one of the Zellner brothers, actually edited it for us because we were so beat up that we were just like, what is this? And he's like, he watched the footage and he was like, this is incredible. And he cut it up in probably 40 minutes.
Yeah, well, he was way more advanced as a filmmaker than we were at the time. And again, luckily, our egos had been beaten out of us enough that we didn't say, like, no, we should see this through because it's ours. We're just like, yes, please help us. And, like, it just, I don't know. I mean, like, we have this big house where all of our movies edit and work, and like there's like a screening every two or three nights there where we just invite the smartest people we know, come on in, tell us what's wrong with what we're doing, and help us fix it. Our whole philosophy, for better or for worse now, is like, if we can somehow manage to get it to 75 or 80% and use our smart peers to help us get it the rest of the way, that's what our job is.
Great. Now we're going to take some questions from the audience.
We can start over here. I'm an independent filmmaker. One of my shorts just screened at the IFC Center in New York City this past week. And now I'm trying to think of who to talk to next. And I know that you guys are reaching out and scooping out like hungry filmmakers as myself. And I was just wondering, do you take things that are unsolicited, or how do you connect?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know,
we're an
odd company in that, like, you know, everybody's like, how do you guys do so much? Do you ever sleep? And we do sleep. And one of the reasons we sleep is we don't develop traditionally like any companies. We don't like accept scripts to read, and we don't like have, you know, people that we don't really know pitch to us, because it just unfortunately sucks up so much time, you know. And a lot of times what we do is we're working with people who have come into our orbit or whose work that we have discovered, and we build projects internally so that we actually make 100% of what we develop, and there's no waste with time. So as much as, like, when you say that, like, literally my heart starts to crack, and it's like, yes, we should work together. But then my answer is like, the truth is, like, you made a great short film that played at the IFC Center. You were on your way. You should not be thinking about anyone, not people like us or anyone, to help you along the way. You should be having something that you might like to make and you might get help with, but always have something actionable that you can make that's the next step up. So I would just say, personally, whatever that short was that you made that clearly clicked with people, take the tone of that, take the seed of that, and try and find a way to make a feature film that is under $1,000, micro-budgeted, that you can make and own, and get that into the next festival, and then you'll sell that for $10,000, and then you'll take that next $9,000 and go make another movie, and you'll build this thing brick by brick, and you will never have to ask people like us whether we take submissions.
I know it's often a point of contention between production companies and Netflix that Netflix won't share, like, viewership data and things like that. Does that bother y'all at all? And do you even think about that or care?
No, we don't care.
No. We'd love to know, but, like, I mean, people are always asking us those questions, and more specifically, are you upset about the death of theatrical distribution? And the truth is like, we have zero entitlement. We feel it's like it's crazy that we're here and that we are being paid to make movies. And I just genuinely just feel like it's nobody's idea that theatrical distribution is dying. It's just what people are doing. Everyone in this room is watching on their laptop, and everybody needs to stop whining about it, because we're all doing it. Yeah. Like, why are we whining about it?
It's really true. I mean, the major complaints we find from other independent filmmakers, we find to be either usually due to entitlement, feeling like they're owed something that we kind of feel like they're not, or something that's like really unreasonable. Like, they won't greenlight my $12 million incest movie with no stars in it. And it's like, they shouldn't.
Yeah.
You should go make it for $1,000 on an iPhone and prove them wrong.
Like,
Sorry. I
wish our movies were playing theatrically. I mean, like, The Puffy Chair was a $10,000 movie that played in 150 movie theaters and, like, had a four-month run in Portland and a, you know, five-month run in Austin. It was amazing. That doesn't happen anymore. But, like, to me, there's so many more advantages to where we are now, specifically the democratization of filmmaking. I mean, any human being with an iPhone and a laptop is now empowered to make a really good-looking movie, so that now, like, the limits to making a good piece of art is simply your own personal creativity, and that's it. So I think that's an incredible place to be personally in terms of where we're at.
Okay, so, like, where I come from, it's a very smallish, like, more, you know, people aren't really focused on filmmaking. They're focused on nursing and accounting kind of thing. And when you're limited to that kind of community, like, you have your small group of people that want to do this, like, but maybe they're not as confident or just secure going into a project. Like, I have my brother, my small group of friends. How do you get the best performances out of these inexperienced people?
That's and a even great with yourself, question.
Because there's times where I'm trying to direct people, and just like, we're starting out, we have no clue what we're doing. And
yeah, it's like, no, such a great question, and I'm glad you asked that, because we didn't figure this out for a long time. We would write things that we hoped we could cast, but then we realized, well, we don't really even have any actors that we can fill in this, and then we would just grab a friend who was misappropriated into that task. They felt bad about it because they weren't good. We felt bad because it wasn't good. And so when we wrote The Puffy Chair, very specifically, we said, well, what's a story we can tell with Mark, my girlfriend at the time, Katie, who I'm now married to, and Jay's really good friend, Rhett, who he was in an acting class. So rather than just write three random roles, we wrote specifically tailored parts for us that we knew we could soar in. And we also wrote specific storylines that had what we call the available material school of filmmaking. All the props around us. I owned a van because I was a musician. We wrote for the two apartments we had. So if you could take out a sheet of loose leaf and just the actors or whoever is willing to be in your movie, try to think honestly about, like, what do they excel in? Is there something that they do that they're just like, you know...
Or more simply, what do you want to see them do?
Yeah, what do you want to see them do? And you kind of feel like they'll be really good at doing.
We wrote Cyrus for John C. Reilly because we had heard that he liked the puffy chair. This is how random that is. We kept getting these, like, communications from people that John C. Reilly was not only watching the puffy chair repeatedly, but forcing other people to watch it.
And so, Jonah Hill was the same thing. He tackled this South by Southwest and said, I love you guys. And we're like, we're going to write a movie for you.
So we wrote that movie for him. We wrote what we wanted to see him do. And then when he showed up on set, it was cool to watch him do that. So do that with your friends and do that with your available materials. Like, back your resources into your script.
And then tell them very clearly, like, guys, I'm not going to get this right on the first weekend. I'm sorry. But I think if we do this like two or three weekends in a row, we're going to hit something. And that kind of humility will help.
And make it really small. Don't try to synthesize everyone. Like, take your most inspired idea revolving around your most inspired friend and the one to two people tops. Thing and make that one thing really good. And I will promise you, if you make one really good thing, other people will flock to your next movie, and then they'll be like begging you to be, and you won't be like, you know, putting them in a headlock and dragging them to set, you know?
Good luck.
Thanks, guys.
All right, guys.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guests were indie filmmakers and brothers Mark and Jay Duplass, whose new book is Like Brothers. They were joined in conversation by Rachel Rosen, Director of Programming for the San Francisco International Film Festival. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.